We're still dealing with the book of Job, and we're still looking at the various speeches between Job and those who are with him. We have seen so far the way that the troubles of Job came upon him and why. We have seen his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and we've looked at their speeches, or their first speeches. Zophar and Eliphaz speak three times, Bildad speaks three times, and Zophar speaks twice. And we finished off last Wednesday, you remember, looking in chapter 25 at the small final speech of Bildad, and noticing how he concludes his words to Job, and that's the last utterance of the three friends, emphasizing how great God is and how small man is. Man's like a bug, like a maggot, and God is a way up and a way beyond our understanding. And we're commenting last time that that final speech of Bildad is pretty typical of the kinds of things that Job's three friends had been saying to him. One of the tragic ingredients of these three friends' speeches, and if you look at these speeches for yourselves, I've only been able to give a rough kind of running commentary of a general kind, but it's been sufficient, I hope, to get a flavor of what these people were on about. And you will wait in vain for any word of comfort. They came to comfort Job, and then they didn't comfort him. They remained silent, and then when they finally did speak, there was nothing but criticism and heavy theology. And they were assuming, of course, that Job was self-righteous, that he must have had some great sin for God to deal with him like this, and he was refusing to confess, and he was refusing to comply with their religious instructions and expectations. And in the end, they just give up. But the point is, the tragic point is, that in all of what they say, there's not one word of understanding or comfort for Job. There's not one word given concerning the free grace of God. They don't seem to have any conception that God is dealing with Job, as Delitzsch puts it, in an administration of love. And they are entirely misunderstanding the reality, and hence are not able to be of any real value in comforting Job. We've also looked at Job's speeches in these earlier chapters, and we've seen that Job, too, is a man deeply distressed, confused, in darkness, discouraged, utterly alone, with no support. And he is a man who is experiencing what is best described, I suppose, as a dark night of the soul. And yet, when all is finalized in the book of Job, as we're going to see when we come to the last chapters, Job is vindicated, he is approved, and Job's three friends are condemned because they spoke in ignorance and harshness and criticism that was totally uncalled for. Now, at the end of chapter 31, we're told there the words of Job are ended. Job's friends have stopped speaking. Job has stopped speaking to them. And then suddenly we're introduced to another character, a man by the name of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the kindred of Ram. One of the commentators makes the point that this description of Elihu is because these people apparently were great orators. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's just a comment that I came across in my reading concerning these things. That may well be the reason why he is so introduced with such a pedigree. Whatever the reason, we find him quite an interesting character. And hitherto he has not appeared in the book of Job. And he appears, as it were, out of the blue. But it is evident from what he says that he has been there. He hasn't been mentioned hitherto, but he's been there all right. And he has been listening in, and he has been chaffing at the bit, so to speak, wanting to say something. Now, it's interesting, when you look at the various speeches in the book of Job, you find that Eliphaz, the oldest of Job's three friends, the first one to speak, the senior man, it seems, In his three speeches, he speaks for 113 verses worth of, speaking. It's interesting that both Bildad and Zophar, Bildad speaks three times, Zophar only twice, but they both speak for 49 verses worth. So out of the three, Eliphaz is by far the most loquacious of the three of Job's friends. When we come to Elihu, we find that he is more talkative than any of them. He speaks for a total of 165 verses. He has got six chapters all to himself. His is the longest speech, and it is a speech that, interestingly, is not replied to either by God or by Job. The Lord makes reference to Job's three friends. Job replies to them all, but Job makes no response whatever to the speech of Elihu. And neither does God. God doesn't even mention him. And that is saying something. Whether it is because his speech is so irrelevant, or whether it is because Job and the Lord are giving this young man the benefit of the doubt and pitying him and saying, well, he'll learn in due season. In the meantime, let's not humiliate him further. We don't know. But the point is, he makes this big speech at the end, six chapters worth, uninterrupted. And then when he stops speaking, we find that the Lord begins to speak out of the whirlwind to Job, not to Elihu, not to the three friends. God doesn't speak to them. He speaks directly to Job. Well, we come then to this final character. And we're not going to look through all his speeches. We have read the beginning of his speech in chapter 32. We read the closing verses of chapter 37, simply because that's the end of his speech. And I think that because we've looked at the beginning and the end, we've got a kind of a flavor of what he has to say, which is really not very much of importance. But nonetheless, he is given his time and he is allowed to say his piece. Well, we're going to look at this chapter 32, and we're going to give a kind of a running commentary just to introduce ourselves to Elihu, the son of Barachel, of Buzite, of the kindred of Ram. Now, the chapter divides itself into four main sections. In verses 2 to 5, we're introduced to something very important at the very beginning of our introduction to Elihu, and that is that he's an angry young man. Four times in these verses, we're told his anger was kindled. And when we ask the question, against whom is his anger kindled, we find he's angry with everybody. He's angry with Job. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled, because he justified himself. That is, he imagined that he had justified himself rather than God. And then we're told that Elihu's wrath was kindled not only against Job, but against Job's three friends. He's angry with everybody that's in the company present. And against his three friends was his wrath kindled, because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now, Elihu had waited till Job had spoken, because they were older than he. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. There have been down in the history of the world generations of angry young men. Those of you who know something of the social history of Britain will know that in the 60s there were a whole generation of poets and playwrights, such as John Osborne, for example, and they were known as the angry young men. The Beatles, the pop groups Make Love Not War, the anti-bomb marches. And it's interesting that in ancient times there were generations of angry young men. If you read some of Plato's dialogues, for example, you'll find that there were angry young men in Athens in ancient classical times, for example. So angry young men is not some new phenomena. Here we have an angry young man. So the first verses begin emphasizing the anger of Elihu. And then we have from verses 6 to 10, we have Elihu, when he begins to speak, he appeals to his youth. He says, I'm young. So he appeals to his youth, pleading youthfulness as to why it was that he had not spoken hitherto. And then from verse 11 to 14, we have him making reference to his patience. He has been very attentive, very patient, while he has been listening to the discourse between Job and his three friends. And then from verse 15 to 22, at the end of the chapter, we have him comparing himself with his three men who had spoken to Job. And he is drawing a contrast between the way that they'd spoken to Job and the way that he is going to speak to Job. So that is what this chapter is all about. And these are only the introductory comments in the speech of Elihu. But when you go through it, if you care to read his speech, you will find that he is rather loquacious, he is talkative, and he says nothing very important. And in the words of E.J. Young, there is a particular kind of harshness, there is a bitterness, and there is an ignorance in the speech of Elihu. And these are the words of the great E. Edward J. Young, the esteemed Old Testament commentator. And that's the way that he describes the speech of Elihu. And I think if you read it, that you'll agree that that's probably a fairly accurate description. Here is a man who, or a young man, he's a young man, he emphasized himself as a young man, and he is imagining that he's going to silence Job once and for all. He's going to give the final answer. He is going to, as it were, say his piece. But when he has finished speaking, he adds nothing of any great value to the debate. So I wouldn't bore you by going through all these speeches. Well, let's look then at the opening verses 2 to 5. We already commented on the fact that he is an angry young man. And he is angry because he imagines that Job has not been convicted. Job has not repented as he ought to do. Job has justified himself rather than God. And Job in some way has silenced the three friends. And he's angry with Job because Job has not confessed to any great sin. He has not complied with the religious requirements of his three friends. And he has not been silenced or beaten in the debate by Eliphaz, Bildad, or Zophar. And so this young man, Elihu, he is angry. And he is obviously frustrated because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. They had failed to make their case. Now, we've already seen Job already in a previous chapter, you may remember. Job inviting his friends to make their case. If you have a charge against me, have I got a sin? Well, tell me what it is. Instead of just talking, instead of accusing, instead of innuendo and general criticism, tell me exactly what it is that I have done that deserves this. And of course, when they continue to speak to Job, as we've seen, they don't come to definitions. In other words, they don't know. And yet they're accusing him of things that, quite frankly, they don't know what they're accusing. And Elihu has been listening in, and he has observed the way in which Job has, in a sense, come through the debate rather victorious rather than the others. So when, and then we're told he had waited till Job had spoken because they were older than he. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. So that's the general introduction to the way in which he was frustrated, angry, discontented, and just longing to say his piece. He has waited, we're told in verse number 4. Now Eliphaz had waited till Job had spoken, because they were older than he. He had waited, he tells us later on, with attention. He'd listened very carefully. But rather than listening and trying to learn some wisdom from the words of Job, if he had listened more carefully to what Job had said, I'm sure that Elihu would not have made some of the silly comments that he goes on to make, because Job has some very interesting comments in his replies to his previous three friends. And Elihu maintains that he's been listening, but in a sense he hasn't been listening. He has been like a young man in the wings, waiting till others speak and just eager, itching to say his piece. Rather than listening and learning something, he has been thinking of how he is going to present his particular speech. He has been sort of rehearsing it to himself, so to speak. So that's the picture. And I'm not trying to be mocking, I'm trying to be biblical. That's the way that the Bible is actually introducing him. And these are the ideas that run right through everything that he says. Well, in verses 6 to 10, he appeals to his youth. And he is, in a sense, saying that he has shown deference to age. He says that I was doing what a young man ought to do, reserving my speech until the elders, the more experienced people, spoke. And he says, I have been showing due deference, but you men, you have not spoken wisdom. Old age does not in itself guarantee wisdom, as he says in verse 7 and verse 9. I said days should speak and multitudes of years should teach wisdom. So he is saying, well, you older men, you ought to have more wisdom than I. But when you go to verse 9, he says, great men are not always wise, neither do the aged understand judgment. In other words, here is a young man, and he's implying that he knows more about life and is able to deal with this very complex situation with Job, that he understands more about these issues than the three older friends, in fact, have done. This is what he's saying. And so he's inviting them now in verse number 10. It is, he says, hearken unto me. You just listen to me, and I'm going to give you the real opinion and the accurate, the final verdict on the matter. So here's a man who's full of himself, actually, full of imagined wisdom. And he probably hasn't learned a great deal, certainly not in listening to the debate hitherto in the book of Job. He seems to have learned very little concerning the real issues. Elihu the son of Berechiah answered and said, I am young, you are very old. Now we don't know how young he was. He may have been a youth, he may have been a mature man, but of some considerable years younger than the others, we don't know. But he regards them as very old. Wherefore I was afraid, he says, and durst not show you my opinion. And what he's implying here is that he has his opinion. As he's listening in to the debate between Job and his three friends, this man already has formed his own judgments. He's not learning something new. He already has his opinions on the matter. So just as Job's three friends, they had their convictions as to what the issue was and how Job was to be dealt with, so this young man, he also has his convictions. And he has his opinion formed. Instead of listening to the evidence, he has already made up his mind, his opinion. And he hasn't shown his opinion because he's waiting until the others finish their speechifying. So this is what he says in verse number 6. I was afraid and dared not show you my opinion. I've got an opinion, all right. And now it's time for me to tell you what my opinion is. That's what he's saying. Days should speak. Multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the mighty giveth them understanding. And what he's doing here is he's beginning to draw the contrast between himself. He's a young man, and he is saying old age should, in theory, learn wisdom and be the wisest counsel. But it's not always the case. There's a spirit in a man, and a man doesn't have to be old to know wisdom and to have understanding. God can give understanding to anybody of any age, he says in verse number 8. There is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth them understanding. So here is a young man, and he is claiming a kind of inspiration for himself. He says, I've got a special kind of enlightenment. And he makes no bones about it. He says, I know the inspiration of the Lord. I know the mind of the Lord in this matter. This is what Elihu is in fact saying. And God is not dependent upon old age and the learning that comes with life's experience. He can inspire people. And it's evident that what Elihu goes on to say, that he is under the delusion, as it turns out, that he is somehow or other under the inspiration of the Lord, and that he is a chosen vessel to teach others, however much older and wiser and experienced they are than himself. So this is what this section, verses 6 to 10, is all about. Great men are not always wise. Well, you see, that's true enough in itself. But in the context, it's something of an insult, both to Job and to Job's three friends, because what he's saying is none of them has spoken wisdom. Job is no wiser than his friends, and his friends are no wiser than Job. And he's been listening to these old men, the four of them, discussing, to-ing and fro-ing, and they don't seem to understand the proper judgment. So he is, as it were, thrusting in a barb of criticism, and saying, as young men often say concerning, it's time that these old ones stood aside and let the young ones come forward and we'll show them how things should be resolved and how issues should be understood. So this is the young man Elihu coming to the fore. And at verse 10, Therefore I said, hearken to me. So he is saying to Job and his three friends, remember he's speaking to Job and Job's three friends are there listening in, and he's saying, now you just listen to me and I'm going to tell you my opinion. And then verses 11 to 14, as we've indicated, he draws attention to the fact that he is really very, very patient. Behold, I waited for your words. I gave ear to your reasons while you searched out what to say. Yea, I attended unto you, and behold, there was none of you that convinced Job or that answered his words. This is rather a cheeky upstart of a young man, to put it mildly. He's insulting these older men who are very confused. They're not beyond criticism. But we would accept the wisdom of Elihu if, in fact, he was able to resolve and understand the issue. But when he goes on to speak, we find he knows no more about it than Job's three friends did. And so there is arrogance coming forth here. I attended unto you, and behold, he says that there was none of you that convinced Job or that answered his words, lest you should say, we have found out wisdom. God trusteth him down, not man. In other words, you haven't defeated Job. If Job is going to be brought down, it's going to be through God. God's going to bring him down. And the implication is that God's going to use me to bring him down. God's going to thrust him down, not just any old man. Now he hath not directed his words against me, neither will I answer him with your speeches. So what he's saying is that you three friends of Job, you have used a certain kind of tack. You have used certain arguments. You've made certain assumptions about Job. And these assumptions have not worked. Job has not been silenced or defeated. He has certainly not been, as it were, embarrassed by your arguments. So I'm not going to use the same arguments that you have used. That's what he's saying. I've listened to your arguments. They have failed. I'm going to use new arguments. And I'm going to come from a different angle. Now, if you read his speeches, and I invite you to do so, you'll find that he doesn't come from a different angle. He comes from the same kind of angle. He just gets stuck right into Job. Indeed, he is more, as E.J. Young says, he is harsher, more ignorant, and there is a kind of criticism that just pours out of Elihu, which in a sense even exceeds what one finds in Job's three friends. So he is not going to say something essentially different, but what he's going to say in anger. There's no evidence, really, that the previous three friends of Job, that they were in anger or frustration. I suppose that they were frustrated with Job and impatient, but they do not seem to display the anger and the belligerence, the emotional antagonism towards Job that young Elihu seems to just pour out right from the very start. Now, we don't know how long Elihu had known Job. We know that Job's three friends were friends. We know that they probably were old friends. They may well have known Job for many years. They certainly would have known him longer than Elihu did. We don't know how long Elihu had known Job. But he begins to make pronouncements against Job, and he doesn't really, as it were, know Job very well, we would assume. So he is speaking entirely out of turn. He is also speaking out of turn against the three friends of Job, because his own arguments are not essentially different from theirs. And so when he accuses them of failure to understand and to resolve the issue, he then, when he begins to speak, does no better. So he is accusing them falsely, and he is also accusing Job falsely. So this is how he begins to speak. Now, he has not directed his words against me. In other words, he says, Job hasn't had to contend with me yet. You see, Job has replied to all of you, and he's got the better of the argument, but he hasn't had a chance to contend against me. Now, when he speaks, as we've already indicated, Job doesn't even bother replying to him. Not because Job can't answer Elihu. Job could just wipe the floor with him. But because Elihu's speech is just the same old stuff. And Job has already answered that kind of complaint and criticism. Job has already dealt with the issues. these issues that have been raised by the three friends are the same ones, essentially, that Elihu raises. Different meat with the same gravy, so to speak. And so it's the same but different. And so Job doesn't even deign to reply to him. But this young man thinks that when Job faces me in debate, well, I will put him in his place. Neither will I answer him with your speeches. You see, this is how he is speaking. Now, the most interesting, and to my way of thinking, the most amusing, and in many ways the most embarrassing section of this whole chapter is in the final verses. And I'm rushing through this evening because we're having a deacon's court after the meeting this evening. But the most embarrassing, and surely Elihu ought to be blushing as he speaks these words. Let us just see what he says, and let us see the unconscious humor that is. He's not intending to be funny at all, but when you read it, it is really, well, one can't help smiling at the amazing arrogance and presumption of this young man. At verse number 15 to the end, he says, "They were amazed, they answered no more, they left off speaking." In other words, they, that is Job's three friends, they had no more to say, they were confounded, they couldn't speak anymore. "When I had waited, for they spoke not, but stood still and answered no more, I said," and this is where the embarrassment surely begins, "I said, I will answer all with, I will answer also my part. I also will show my opinions, for I am full of matter." This word matter means I'm full of thoughts, I'm full of opinions, I'm full of knowledge. I'm just bursting, as he goes to say, I'm like a bag of new wine. I'm just bursting, ready to pour out. I can hardly keep it in. I am full of matter, he says. I'm full of wisdom and words. The spirit within me constrains me. Behold, he says, verse 19, my belly is as wine, which hath no vent. He is picturing here new wine, which has not yet fermented fully, putting into a wineskin, and as we know, when you put new wine, the fermentation continues, the gases continue, the wine skin expands, and if it is, if it needs to be vented from time to time to release the pressure. And he says, I'm like a kind of a pressure cooker. And he says, I've got no vent, and I'm just ready to explode with wisdom. And when I burst open, there's going to pour out of me all the matter, all the opinions, all the wisdom that I'm full of is all going to just pour out. And people are going to be just, as it were, astonished at the sheer magnitude of the wisdom of Elihu. This is what he's saying. He's speaking of himself. He's forgetting the biblical injunction, let another man's lips praise you and not yourself. For I am full of matter, the spirit within me constrains me. Behold, and this idea of constraint is the idea of pressurized, actually. It means closed up. I am being constrained to speak of the wisdom that is in me. Now you just listen to me and you'll learn something, you older men. Behold, my belly is as wine which has no vent. It is ready to burst like new bottles or new wine skins. I will speak that I may be refreshed. In other words, I will find release in speaking. Now, we've all met people like this, of course, and I dare say we've all been like this. I can, in some ways, identify myself with this. There are times when we have been just bursting to speak and give our opinions, and then when we do give our opinions, we find that they're pretty ordinary after all, and other people have thought of them far better than we have ever thought of them, and explain them better than we are able to do. So all of us here, we've got to sort of smile at this young man. He's just learning, you see. He's sort of learning to shave. And he's probably preaching his first sermon. He's so keen and he's enthusiastic about it. And he's probably just cannot wait. One can imagine him bouncing and just ready to butt in the moment that silence comes. He is ready to burst, as he says, like a wineskin ready to burst open. And he's going to find release. In other words, all the frustration, all the reserve, all the anger that is welling up within him as he sees the way that Job and his friends have not resolved the issue, it is all going to burst out and he's going to settle the matter once and for all. It is ready to burst like new bottles. I will speak that I may be refreshed. I will open my lips and answer. And then he makes this claim about himself in the last two verses. He says he's not going to flatter anybody, and he certainly does not flatter Job in the things that he says. He says, I don't know how to flatter. He says, I'm going to be totally impartial. That's what he says. Let me not, I pray you, accept any man's person, neither let me give flattering titles unto man, for I know not how to give flattering titles. In so doing, my Maker would soon take me away. Now, what is he saying here? He's implying that Job's friends have gone rather easy on Job. He is implying that because they were Job's friends and owed him a certain amount of reverence, that they were therefore kind of holding back, and that they were being partial to Job. And they really should have just told Job a home truth and just said what needed to be said. That's what Elihu is saying. Well, he says, I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to hold back out of any false respect for Job. I'm not going to flatter him by refusing to say the plain truth. I'll call it as it is. This is what he says. And furthermore, he says, I know not how to give flattering titles, for in doing so, my Maker would soon take me away. So here is a man who says constantly that everything I do in the fear of the Lord. Everything I say by the inspiration of the Lord. Every word that I'm going to utter is God's word. And when Job is finally silenced by me, it's going to be God dealing with him, bringing him down through me. I'm the man who's going to put Job in his place and speak finally for God. Because unless I do this, my Maker's going to take me away, you see. He says, I stand before God in this. Now, I don't want to add too many comments to all of this, but surely you see the kind of character, the shallowness of this young man. The inexperience, of course, shows. The arrogance shows. The false humility. I have waited, pretending to wait, give devil. It's all a mock make-believe. And as E.J. Young says, the exuberance of youth is poured out in vicious anger. And when he finally stops speaking after his 165 verses of non-stop loquaciousness, Job doesn't reply to him. There are some times in life when we just don't speak to people back. Answer not a fool according to his folly, says the scripture. There are some sermons, I suppose, and quite frankly, they're not worth listening to, and maybe many of mine have fallen into that category for all I know. But certainly there are some things that people say that are just so misleading, so inaccurate, so ignorant in terms of content, and so misapplied that it would be futile to reply to them. And it may well be, as I say, that Job just turns away from this young man and deals with him gently. Because if this young Elihu was spoken to in the terms in which he is speaking to Job and to Job's three friends, then he would deserve a very severe mouthful and rebuke, and he should really be brought down a peg or two. And the Lord doesn't speak to him. The Lord doesn't speak of him. Job ignores him, and God ignores him. Because people like Elihu, very often, the best thing we can do is simply ignore them, pass them by, because they have nothing of value to contribute. They imagine that they know more than they actually know. And the fact of the matter is that their arrogance and their ignorance precludes them from learning. Because while they pretend to listen, they're not listening. They're seeking to correct. They're seeking to give an opinion. And oh, if only they had the platform. Just like Elihu, he can't wait. He has been bursting. He has been, as it were, impatient, waiting until the opportune moment. And when he begins to speak, he just reveals himself to be the angry young man that in reality he is. And with the speech of Elihu, the speeches of Job's friends come to an end at the end of chapter 37. So that's the kind of thing that Job was up against, you see. Three friends who perhaps meant well but did very, very badly. A young man who doesn't even pretend to be well disposed to Job, he immediately goes in with criticism and with pointing out how wise and how, even although I'm full of youth, nonetheless I'm full of wisdom, full of matter, like a wineskin ready to burst open. And this is the kind of thing. No wonder when James in his epistle in the New Testament in chapter 5 speaks of, you have heard of the endurance of Job. We are to understand the endurance that Job had to put up with from people around him. Not only the affliction of the Lord and the providence of the Lord, that can be very hard to bear, but there are times in life when you and I have to endure people. And we have to put up with people who sometimes, quite frankly, don't understand what they're talking about. And we have to put up with their implied criticisms. And we have to just at times turn away and ignore them, as Job did and as the Lord did with Elihu. Well, we're going to look next time when we come to the book of Job, we're going to look at the Lord's speech in chapter 38, and the Lord finally begins to speak. We're finished with Job and his friends speaking. We'll see what Job has to say in the last chapter, but it's an interesting way that the Lord, when he finally does speak, it's interesting what he speaks about, because he doesn't speak about Job's troubles at all. He speaks about nature. He speaks about animals and clouds and water and seasons and ice, and he speaks about the things that we see all around us. He speaks about the doctrine of creation when he finally begins to speak. But we'll look at that next week.